talked last time about some of the major problems characteristic of modern society, and how that seems to create a situation of spiritual poverty. And I mentioned how I see depersonalization as one of the major problems, and how that can lead to an identity crisis, simply because identity is a relational thing. Identity is built in a community, and if community and relationships are broken down, the room in which identity can be built is undermined, and the positive values which are necessary for a positive identity are also undermined. Also, sociological studies show that when our relationships to each other are broken down and undermined, so seems our relationship and our understanding of God to be undermined, that that the sense of relationship to other people and to God is intertwined. And I think depersonalization is something that Sölle deals a lot with, and I'd like to read here from a letter from an American student that she quotes in this book, and I think it shows very well how fear and loneliness and alienation separates us from what we want to be or what we could become. The letter goes, "Please hear what I'm not saying. Don't be deceived by me. Don't let the face I make deceive you. I wear 1,000 masks, and I'm afraid to lay them aside. Not one of these masks is the real I. Pretending is an art that has become second nature to me. Do not be deceived by it. For God's sake, don't be fooled. I give the impression that I'm an affable fellow who has not a single inner or outer care in the world. I give the impression that confidence is my name and being cool my game, that I'm a quiet stream, so in command of things that I need no one. But don't believe me. Please don't believe me. Outwardly, I may appear quite confident and serene, but that is a mask I wear. There's nothing behind that mask. Beneath it, I am what I really am, confused, afraid, alone. But I conceal all that. I wouldn't want anyone to notice it. If someone shows the slightest awareness of my weakness, it throws me into a panic, and I dread exposing myself to others. That is precisely the reason I desperately devise masks behind which I can hide. A clever, slovenly facade helps me to pretend and to withstand the look of a knowing eye which would see through me. And yet, such a look would be my salvation. I know it. If such a look were only one of acceptance or of love, that is the only thing which can give me the security I cannot give myself, the assurance that I really am of value and worth. But I do not say that to myself. I don't dare. I'm afraid to say it. I'm afraid that your look is not one of acceptance and love. I'm afraid that you will think ill of me, laugh at me. I'm afraid that your laughter will kill me. I'm afraid that deep down inside of me I amount to nothing, and that you reject me for this. So I play my little game, my desperate little game. On the outside, I show a facade of confidence. Beneath, I'm a trembling child. Please listen carefully. Try to hear what I say, but what I really... Try to hear not what I say, but what I really want to say. What I need to say in order to survive, yet cannot. I loathe this game of concealment. I detest this superficial game I play. It isn't honest. I wish I could be genuine and spontaneous, just be myself, but you must help me. You must extend your hand, even though it may seem to be the last thing I need. You alone can take this empty glaze of death from my eyes. You alone can call me to life. Every time you are gentle and friendly to me, every time you encourage me, when you try to understand me because you really care about me, my heart takes on wings. Small and fragile wings, to be sure, but wings. Your intuition, your empathy, and the strength of your understanding breathe new life into me, I want you to know. I want you to know how important you are for me, that you, if you will, can make of me the human being that I really am. How I hope you want to do it. Only you can tear down the wall behind which I tremble. Only you can tear away my mask. Only you can rescue me from my dread and insecurity and my loneliness. Please do not pass me by. It will not be easy for you. My long-standing sense of worthlessness erects high, thick walls. The closer you get to me, the more blindly I strike back. I resist with tooth and nail the very thing for which I cry out. But I'm told that love is stronger than any thick wall, and I'm counting on that. Please try to tear down this wall with hands that are strong and firm, yet gentle, for a child is so sensitive. Who am I, you ask? I'm someone you know very well. I'm everyone you meet, every man, every woman whom you encounter. I can't help thinking of a very good friend I had in Vancouver who said to me, the most important thing when you are with other people, besides giving them yourself, is to give them themselves. I think this letter shows very well the predicament of our situation and the predicament of our relationships. This is what Sulle calls death by bread alone, it is inspired by the quotation from the Old Testament that people don't live by bread alone, and she turns it around and say that we die by bread alone. That seems to be the curse of our modern society. I found that Sulle is in a surprising agreement with Bergman and the North American concern for spirituality, and I'm sure that Sulle has been surprising in that to many people in Europe, because spirituality is not such a strong concern in Europe as it seems to be here. So she shocked Christians by being so political, and she shocked political people by being so spiritual. I find that her value lies in that combination. And as I said, she started out with a political commitment and found out that was not enough, that you had to do the inward journey too. And actually, this book is in Danish called The Inward Journey and The Way Back. She puts a lot of emphasis on this, the way back, so that we don't just end up in a very belly button kind of spirituality where we get so obsessed with our own spirituality. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Who is this you're reading from? That?
Sulle.
That's Sulle.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that the same person I recall, Sully?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Hi.
It is. They're probably saying it right.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the German.
And to confuse you more, I say across in between someplace.
I find, though, perhaps that she is more radical than Bergman is. She says that we need the combination of mysticism and revolution. And also Bergman talks about that we need to change our world view. But as I got into talking about it last time, I don't see that he takes, you know, the practical political consequences of what does that mean. That he works more with the spiritual part of it only, and that perhaps Sölle gets the two better integrated, you know, the inner spirituality and the concrete practical consequences of it. For example, she says the truth is concrete, so that meaning that truth is not something theoretical, a concept or a conviction, whatever, but it is something that you work out. So spirituality is for her very much a lifestyle or something that is worked out and not just something which is inside you and which concerns only your relationship to God. Let me read that. She writes, what it means is the death that surrounds us on every side in the very midst of life, the death of alienation, of loneliness. That is what she means by death by bread alone. And it is a concern for her to shift the emphasis of spirituality from being occupied with the thought of death and eternal life after death to talking about life here and now. So that is why she talks about the little deaths in life, and finds that traditionally Christianity has talked too much about death and eternal life instead of talking about life here and now and death as it ruins our life here now, and she argues that when the Bible talks about death, it actually talks about how death destroys our life here now. And she writes, we are so alienated from other people that we experience neither the bitterness nor the sweetness of grief. This is the hell that swallows us up in the very midst of life as we go about the motions and routines of life. And because we live for bread alone, we die by bread alone. And I understand this to say that that if we really live life intensely, we cannot live without grief or suffering, and that health or salvation does not mean to simply, you know, get rid of suffering, but it means to be able to cope with suffering and integrate it as a part of your, of who you are and part of your life. It was against just this kind of death that Jesus organized resistance. To have faith means to take a stand for life. The conquest of death is first announced not in Jesus' resurrection, but in the stories connected with his life. Death reigns where violence and alienation run rampant. The more we live without human relationships, the more we accept and tolerate death. Neither Jesus nor those who, like him, battle against violent death looked upon physical death as the worst thing that can happen to us. They feared a life that is ruled and controlled by death more than they feared death itself. As Jesus saw it, it is worse to live a life that is strangled and suffocated by the death that pervades in the midst of life than it is to die and be laid in the grave. And she continues, in other words, the less a person has lived up to life's possibilities, the more difficult it is to die. And she goes so far to say that the goal of the Christian is to accept the reality of natural death and to learn to die. So what she is occupied with is healing from the little deaths in life, more than it is healing from final natural death. And she says about religion or spirituality that it is a need to experience and to confer meaning. There can be no existence without this search for meaning. It is through a religious act that people set meaning over against meaninglessness, wholeness over against being fragmented, courage over against fear. Obviously, it is necessary for us to distinguish whether we are dealing with mere repetition of meaning that is oriented towards the way things are, or with new and alternative proposals of meaning. And she also says about the function of spirituality is on one side to comfort, and on the other side to challenge, so that you can understand the Christian community as an alternative community or an alternative way of living, which is comforting us in the face of the evil that surrounds us, but is also challenging us to go beyond that community and fight the evil. So just to sum up, Sulu would see fear and loneliness and alienation as main problems, and she says that it leads to apathy, which is really a key word or key concern for her to, you know, arouse people from that apathy, because apathy allows for a model or a pattern of relationships where that is dominated by aggressiveness and defensiveness, where we either find ourselves as the oppressors or those being oppressed. And apathy allows also for the material success model to influence relationships, so that we don't value each other for the people we are, but you know, for our what our profession is, or our material wealth, or our power as persons, or whatever. And she says that apathy leads to spiritual poverty and finally to suffering in many forms. And that the function of reality is two things mainly, namely totality and meaning. To give us a sense of totality and give us a sense of meaning. And, yeah.
What does the first mean?
Totality. It means wholeness.
Okay.
That spirituality should be able to give us that sense of wholeness and a sense of identity and a sense of meaning, and that it should lead to a paradigm shift in our lifestyle, a way of living in interaction and participation and solidarity, and to bring these things about, she sees as the healing task of the church. I guess that's all I would.
Okay. we go on with chapter 2, and if you want to look at it. Questions and suggestions for thinking that I gave you the other day, I think we'll kind of follow along with this, because I'd like to hear your thoughts and your sharing with one another. You've all been able to read the chapter, and there's no reason to go through that in detail, but as a guide through it and to do some sharing with each other. What Yenna just read, that letter from the student, fit in so well, and what she had just quoted also, the one, I think it was on page 22, when in our text, the third paragraph down says, the root cause of our alienation is fear. Those words were used very much, both by that student who wrote and also by Dorothy Soley and what she has just quoted here too. And as I was starting to read from Ordinary People again, and I realized how much fear enters into the picture of Cal too after he returns from having been treated for his suicide attempt, and in all his relationships and so on, how fear continually grips him and gets a hold of him. I think the heading of this chapter, Disease, Disintegration, and Death, after reading the chapter, I take this death here primarily to be referring to premature death, or the kind of death that Dorothy was referring to as the death by bread alone. In other words, not the final death that we all, as mortal human beings, will be experiencing, but that which is premature. Let's start then on page 20 and just do some sharing of what thoughts you've had as you kind of went through this. The last section of this, where it starts out as dis-ease is the absence of ease, that the breakdown in the communication of systems in the body in which the physical, mental, and spiritual needs of the person are not being expressed in a way that is unique to self. That struck me, this idea that we all have our own uniqueness and the ways that we need to express our needs. And if this is not done, this is dis-ease, or disease, as we more commonly associate it. And what this really is a failure in adapting to life. The little diagram there, his rationale then being that the main cause of this happening is fear that comes out of this neutral living that was referred to in the first chapter. Any of you have any thoughts or comments you'd like to to share?
Yes, looking at this diagram of neutral living here, I'd say this is more a comment I'm critical of myself. I remember a diagram that Fritz Norstedt made similar to this that I thought was a lot more logical, a lot easier, and I meant to bring it, but it's in my room somewhere.
If you find it, bring it tomorrow.
But did you have a critique of this model?
Yes, he basically said reaffirmed that fear was the factor. We start off with a symptom, and we can either treat the symptom, or we become afraid of the symptom, and it leads down to, I can't remember all the details, but it's a downward spiral, fear taking us over and fear taking us back until eventually the symptom becomes something far too serious for medicine or psychologists or psychiatrists to deal with, and it leads to a premature death. However, he said that the thing that will be counter force of fear, that will counteract it, is love, and an effect an example that he gave was how his son learned a new trick one day when he was quite young, rolling down the hill on the side, and he had to go and show his father this. And he was rolling down the hill and he hit his head on a rock, and he said it was very loud, and he was running down to his son, and his son was running back towards him screaming just in such pain, ran past his father, whose arms were open wide, ran into the house to his mother. And so Fritz said that, well, I did the logical things. I went into the freezer and I opened up the ice tray and I started smashing ice and putting it in a washcloth, and goes into the living room, and all, he said, all that the kid was getting was he was being held in his mother's arms, and she was saying, there, there, mommy loves you, mommy loves you. And it calmed the child down so that he forgot all about the pain, walked right past Fritz with the ice pack, and started rolling down the hill again. So I don't think Bakken used the effect of love as a counter effect of fear. Well, we are dealing more with seeking the kingdom of God and all things will fall into place. But I thought that was a very interesting thing that I heard in a previous lecture, and I thought it would be helpful to the group.
Thanks. I think my own feeling is that as we go through it, that we'll find that he does also spend quite a lot of time dealing with love as the counterforce, but we'll see if that, that seems to be a, or not as we go on. On page 22, where in the middle again, where he talks about the root cause of our alienation is fear, the propelling force that keeps us fragmented and living in neutral. What is it that we fear? To say that fear is what keeps us living in neutral. But what is it that we fear? What do you understand by that, if you agree with that? What are we fearful of? Why do we cling to living in neutral?
Not being accepted. Taking a stand.
I think of fear.
I think I associate so much commitment with wholeness and love, and something that I'm not naturally inclined to embrace, that I'm almost afraid of wholeness for the doors of commitment that will swing open, and responsibilities and demands, which will, you know, recreate wholeness over and again, but yet it take energy and work and discipline and all those tough things.
That opens right into one of those later quotes when suggested thinking about that too, where he says, do you really want to be whole? It's easy for us to say that about someone who has a physical thing. In fact, I think we often do. We say, well, they don't really want to get well, or they're clinging to their physical ill, or we ourselves might feel that. But to consider it in a non-relationship to just something physical, it's to ask ourselves, it's on page 27 if you want to move over to that, at the end of the first paragraph. We too are asked if we really want to get well, to acknowledge the painful truth of our lives and what we most desire of the Lord. And I suddenly found that very interesting, to try to think in that in terms of non-physical self. Because we're talking about wholeness as being all-inclusive, and it's not just dealing with our physical bodies. So then do we really want that wholeness, that wellness? And that's exactly what Kevin was saying. That's part of the fear, because it's going to mean some kind of commitment. What thoughts did you have on that as you were thinking about that? Did that lead you into any deeper consideration of that, rather than just, oh yeah, that's true?
I just don't understand who wouldn't want to be well. You know, maybe we need someone to show us, but who wouldn't want to be well?
One of the things that he points out, I think it's in the first chapter, is how much of the medical institution and apparatus and training and dealing with people these days is with these kinds of chronic illnesses, things like heart disease and lower back pain, headaches, you know, those kinds of things that don't seem to be amenable to cure, like we cure bacterial or acute illnesses, infections and so on. But that the treatment tends to cover up the symptoms or operate, you know, and take out part of the organism that's and do away with it, you know, those types of things. So, you know, in answer to your question, I'd say when people have these kinds of problems, do they want to really investigate their sources? You know, or are they fearful of really finding out what is the cause of those things? Like it may be a person's job-related or family-related relationships, you know, things like that. I just use as examples. So they may, you know, say, well, the pain of getting my life straight in these other areas is too fearful for me to really undertake. So I'll just put up with the